Hello, everybody. My name is Sean T. Collins, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, along with various other television programs. And I am the co-author of the official annotated of Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and series editor Anne Grohl. And joining me today, as always, is my illustrious co-host.
Oh, very illustrious. This is Stefan Sasse. I am the creator of the Nerd Stream Era, my blog about all things nerd. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and recently my first standalone ebook for Song of Ice and Fire has come out. It is known Season 3 Deconstructed, which takes a look at the Game of Thrones show, so check it out if you haven't yet. And with us today is a very special guest, and he is introducing him now.
Okay. Hi, I'm Steve Atwell. I run Race for the Iron Throne, which takes a historical and political look at both the books and the TV series. There you go.
We're very excited to have Steve aboard because his expertise really lends itself well to this installment's topic of the podcast, which is an historical novella. Almost doesn't feel like quite the right word for it because so much of it is written as history, the Princess and the Queen, or the Blacks and the Greens, being a history of the causes, origins, battles, and betrayals of that most tragic bloodletting known as the Dance of the Dragons, as set down by Archmaester Gilding at the Citadel of Old Town. That's George R. R. Martin's contribution to Dangerous Women, the science fiction, fantasy, etc. anthology that he co-edited with his frequent co-editor Gardner Dozois. Featuring various stories by various luminous bodies in the realm of fantastic fiction about female protagonists. And Dangerous Women, I'm sorry, the Princess and the Queen is a very different beast from what I think we're accustomed to from Martin, not just in A Song of Ice and Fire proper, but also in the previous spin-off novellas, The Duncan Egg Tales, which I think perhaps people had been primed to expect that sort of thing, despite the fact that this story was known to have spun out of the world book that he's preparing with Elio and Linda Antonsen from Westeros, and sort of guidebook to the world. It wound up being a kind of unique in his body of work. And so I'm just going to pass things to Steve, if that's all right with everybody.
Sure. Kind of interesting thing about this short story is that it is written in the form of a history, which gives it that kind of global, all-encompassing perspective that is kind of the opposite of the first-person narrative that really characterizes everything else in the world of Westeros. The interesting thing about this story of the first great civil war in the history of the Targaryen dynasty is how much it overturns what we thought we knew about the history of Westeros from sort of bits and pieces of things that people thought about in passing in the rest of the series. And I have a number of sort of interesting topics, things that jumped out to me that kind of changed the way that I viewed the history of this world. So I'll just start with one, which is the fact that they discuss a great council occurring in the year 101 AL to resolve a disputed succession, which is pretty new because we'd previously thought that there was only ever one great council, that it was in 231 AL also to deal with this question of a disputed succession. And this suggests that these great councils were a more well-established historical model of how authority and legitimacy operated in Westeros, which perhaps changes what we think might have been behind, say, the Sothron Ambitions conspiracy, Rhaegar's conspiracy, etc. Discussion.
Okay. Please elaborate.
Okay. I thought I was going to get you guys to do some of the work. The Great Council that they talk about in this story seems to have taken place when I'm going to guess that Jaehaerys's son died of old age, waiting for his father to die. So that there was a question of succession between grandchildren. And all of the lords of Westeros, you know, cast their vote. And that those votes were recorded because they show that when the Greens attempt their coup d'etat, one of the things they do is they go back to the historical record and see who was for the male candidate and who was for the female candidate. And then, you know, we know of the one that happened after the Blackfyre Civil War and the Great Spring Sickness. To settle, you know, what do you do with the succession when, you know, an entire royal line dies of the plague? And, I guess why I thought this was significant is that it suggests that this idea that sovereignty or legitimacy in some way rests in all of the lords of the realm gathering in one place to make a common decision was more widespread than just this one event, and that this might be what the Southern Ambitions conspiracy was aiming to do, was to essentially call for a great council and control a majority voting bloc within that great council, sort of in the way that, you know, the Estates General, you know, in the Ancien Régime gave rise to a French Revolution. It sort of seems like that.
Well, you
okay,
know,
yeah, that makes sense.
Right. Well, power resides where men believe it resides, right? Like, the interesting thing I think about The Princess and the Queen is that it's making this point extremely explicitly. Like, I remember there's a scene early on where I think it is Otto Hightower who travels from King's Landing to Dragonstone to present Aegon's terms of surrender to
It's the Grand Maester.
It's the Grand Maester, I'm sorry. To present Aegon's terms of surrender to Rhaenys. And she said, you remember my dad, right? You remember that council, right? You remember who he declared his heir, right? Well, then what the hell are you doing here telling me what my terms of surrender are? You know what... you know I'm supposed to be the heir. And of course there's no way to answer that, because supposed to be doesn't really amount to anything, you know, because Aegon was in a position to make that claim and to have force of arms to back it up, and that's pretty much that, you know. And I think one of the primary concerns of this story is illustrating that the idea that legitimacy is some sort of the concept of legitimacy does not have the integrity it's supposed to have. It's not something that exists out there in some platonic form and you can figure it out every time and it sort of is beamed down from on high. You know, it comes down to if there's a matter of dispute, you know, powerful people are going to have to make decisions. It's not math. And it's not, you know, nor is it magic. It's politics. And
on the flip side, though, you know, legitimacy does count for something, because, you know, as we can see, you know, despite the fact that Rhaenyra was, is that how it's pronounced, by the way? Rhaenyra?
Rhaenyra, I always say.
Rhaenyra, okay.
I don't know.
I would go with Rhaenyra, yeah. Emphasis on the second.
That sounds better, Rhaenyra. Yeah. That despite the fact that she was completely outnumbered in the beginning, you know, really was very much, you know, was later. You know, she gets the support of the Vale, of the North, of, you know, huge chunks of the Seven Kingdoms, in part because there are people who view legitimacy as important, as something that they are willing to fight for.
I would object there. It's
okay.
Yeah, it seems to me the timeline of events is that pretty much no one except the Valyrians, who I want to talk about later anyway, but no one except for them really declares for her in the beginning. And then she sends her sons out, specifically the eldest and the second eldest, and the eldest one makes the dangerous flight to the Vale and to the North, and it is him on his dragon that sways the people around, and it is explicitly mentioned that he is a very... charismatic person, someone who can talk people into something. They didn't just do it for love of Rhaenyra's cause, but because they were somehow convinced by a guy on a dragon. And that's another point. We cannot really trust this history. While it is written from a omnipotent view of this maester, it doesn't have to say anything about historical accuracy. So it might very well be that this guy had some other arguments besides, hey, look, Rhaenyra is a really nice guy, please support her. He came on a dragon, after all. So this seems to be viewed as the main source of legitimacy, and they repeatedly talk about how important it is
most?
To have this dragon diplomacy, you know?
Diplomacy.
That's about it. If you come to someone without a dragon, you are not taken for a guy of fortitude, you know? Mm-hmm. You have to have a dragon, and you have to show it. It has to be there. You have to fly it to people. You can't just send a raven like it is done in the Song of Ice and Fire saga proper, but you have to fly there personally and make your cause. That is, I think, an element that Stevens and Ellis just overlooked a bit.
Well, I think
fair enough.
Legitimacy, to me, it seems, as an a priori consideration, ends the moment that Lord Beesbury bleeds out in front of the entire small council, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, legitimacy is nice. I'm not saying legitimacy is not a factor. I think there are people who absolutely, don't make excuses to weasel out of their obligations based on that. I mean, there's difference of opinion, you know, and this is something that's come up in the main series, you know, when Stannis is sort of, you know, did I owe allegiance to the king or to my brother? Technically, I owed allegiance to them both. So what did I do? What was the right thing, etc.? So there can be differences of opinion. But there are people who legitimately consider those differences of opinion and actually weigh them. It's not all just like, well, this is going to benefit me and mine, and we have more swords and more dragons, so fuck this. It's not everyone's like that, but enough people that it's worth keeping in mind, right?
I mean, and I think the case of the Baratheons is kind of a really good crystallization of all of this, in there are legitimate reasons for this guy to side with either side, you know, in terms of where the Baratheons are related and so on and so forth. And ultimately, it comes down to, you know, he wants a marriage, and he's not going to do anything without a marriage.
He's not going to do anything with one either.
Yeah, Lucaris, or Luke, kind of makes a sort of, I guess you would call it a reverse Robb Stark. He refuses to make a marriage alliance, and then that, you know, everything goes to pot. So the next thing that I thought was kind of an interesting detail that seems to fall out of the narrative is the Red Kraken. There's all these interesting labels and names that suggest that, you know, a particular member of a house was really significant. And this Red Kraken, you know, seems to be someone who both sides, you know, see as a wild card who could go either side, who has some influence and some pull. And he seems to drop out of the narrative almost completely.
Yeah, you're right. I totally forgot about him.
There's a lot of dogs that don't bark, which I think is... That's something, I, as someone who runs a Tumblr and gets a lot of questions sent directly to me that are picked from discussion going on message boards and on other people's Tumblrs, you get a lot of that kind of redounds to the benefit of questions where, like, oh, look at this thing that I noticed. That's interesting. Maybe it means this. And I think a lot of those things, there may be something to it, but just as many and probably way, way more are just loose ends, red herrings, little details that aren't intended to amount to much. And someone like the Red Kraken, which seems like it's going to be this intriguing element of the story, but winds up being essentially a footnote. I think you can take that back to the main text and say to yourself, not all of this stuff is going to wind up mattering. A lot of it is world building, fun stuff to just sort of seed out there and flesh out this world. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have a plot impact later on down the line. That's my takeaway from that.
Yeah. That sounds about right. So the next thing that I noticed is that it seems to me there's a consistent pattern that Lannisters don't do well in civil wars, because the Lannisters get absolutely massacred at the Battle of
the God's Eye. Let's call it that.
Yeah, the Battle of the God's Eye, or I think it's also called the Fish Feed.
The Fish Feed, right.
Which, you know, one thing that's interesting about that battle is that, one, it's kind of interesting to see that the Starks and Freys, and that the Freys weren't always complete incompetents and bastards. It's also interesting to see the River Lords as a genuinely fearsome military force. So anyway, the Lannisters get wiped out in that battle. In the Blackfyre, they go through, I think, like two lords in a row when they get completely crushed by Fireball. And then, you know, look at what's happened to them in the War of the Five Kings. And it's sort of what I thought was curious is you'd think that Tywin would be less quick to start civil wars given his family history.
Yeah, well, he's better at it, I guess.
Well, ultimately, is he? Because I think they're fucked in the long term. But here's an interesting thing. If the Lannisters are historically lousy at civil wars, how are they still the Lannisters? How do they still control Casterly Rock? How are they still the dominant power in the West? How do they still control one of the largest cities, or two of the largest cities?
My hypothesis would be that civil wars are fairly infrequent. I mean, we're talking about three of them in 300 years.
Well, four if you count Maegor versus the Faith, right?
Yeah, but I didn't get the sense from that was particularly a war in which the Lannisters would have. There wasn't a sense from the text that that the great houses took the side of the Faith in the Civil War.
Right.
So, you know, my guess would be that, you know, they spent the time in between the 100 years. I mean, you know, it sucks that they lose 2,000 men and, you know, a lord or two, but those are setbacks that you can survive and recover from. It's when, you know, something like the War of Five Kings comes along and the entirety of the Westerlands are ravaged and you lose almost, you know, the whole of the house, that I think that's when a house goes into real decline.
Yeah, I have two things about that. The one thing is, I think the Lannisters, they managed to lose quickly enough in these civil wars. If you are losing that quickly, you can go out pretty much undisturbed because everybody has better concerns than to punish traitors. But if you fight to the end and then find yourself on the losing side, that's when you have a problem. And the second thing is, did anyone else notice how small the armies were? I mean, it's this big host of 4,000 that at some time comes down, and compared to the numbers of the War of Five Kings, that's just a skirmishing party, you know? Why is that?
I assume dragons abrogate the need for enormous masses of men.
Yeah, that might be.
I think it's similar but slightly different, which is I think that dragons make large concentrations of men a bad idea.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Which is... Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Field of Fire, right, you had 50,000 men gathered. That's a big army. And then, a tenth of them get torched, and the battle's over instantly.
Right.
So I think the idea is that if you have the same amount of men, but just, split up in chunks of a couple thousand, well, first of all, that allows you to do more things at once and cover more territory at once, but it also means the dragon can't be everywhere.
And
that's probably explains, you know, that certainly explains with the Dornish, you know, how they successfully maintain their independence. It probably also, explains why the revolt of the Faith, like, lasted as long as it did, despite the presence of dragons. Which, by the way, one interesting thing I noted about Dorn, which doesn't seem to have gotten involved even sort of opportunistically in terms of like raiding the Reach or anything, is that we learned that Meraxes was killed in Dorn by an archer, seemingly kind of in a fluke. And that might explain why Aegon decided to not pursue conquest of Dorne.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I totally overlooked that detail.
Yeah, you mean this is a bad omen? I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think
it's sort of a cost benefit analysis.
Yeah.
It's like,
right.
You know, we can see even at a time in which supposedly the drag. You know, both sides had a lot of dragons, you know, before the end of the dragons. They've got, you know, like about a dozen of fighting age. So it's not like that they have large reserves.
Yeah. If I may suggest one thing before we go too much into dragons, and I guess we have quite a bit about that, let's just stay on the secular politics. I have one point, because the Valyrians is also something that struck me while reading this thing, because Valyrian isn't exactly a house that gets any mention in later, neither in Duncan Egg nor in the Song of Ice and Fire saga. And I guess they're pretty much wiped out in the Dance of the Dragons, and were not exactly a major house, but a strong and big one in any case. I mean, or the level of the Freys or something like that. In the Dance of the Dragons, I mean, they command the biggest fleet and everything. And if I remember my history correctly, the Valyrians were the other family that came from Valyria in sort of a advising and serving capacity to the Targaryens, right?
So, yeah, the Valyrians were the first master of ships.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So because it is interesting that they are wiped out, because I guess this will change the Targaryen power structure within the realm after the Dance of the Dragons even further, because now you have to take in one great house that has a fleet, which most likely will be the Tyrells or the Baratheons, one of them, and make them the master of ships. And you cannot really rely on the Valyrian blood, which seems to be fiercely loyal to at least some Targaryens. So I guess that also very much weakens the Iron Throne.
Yeah, the role that they seem to play in this chapter. In the story, seems to be that, like, when you have dragons, having other people with the blood of old Valyria around they're useful backup. They can be relied on to ride dragons if necessary. And so that probably part of what happened is that after the dragons were gone, that House Valyrian lost a lot of influence because part of their historical role was gone.
Yeah, might be. I don't remember what happened to the old admiral. I mean, he said in the beginning of the war the gods preserved him for something like this, and I can't really remember. Did he go down?
He dies in a naval engagement, I believe.
Yeah, I believe, but I couldn't point my finger on it.
I'll look for it. Someone else talk while I do that.
Yeah. I think we can go over to the dragons now, because that's basically what the story is about, and we do get a ton of information about dragons and even more questions than before, I guess. And perhaps we can just go into the fan mode and talk about the theory of dragons. You know what I mean? How do they hatch? What do you need to do? How can you ride them? And we get some stuff. For me, the most important thing is, how do you get them to hatch in the first place? And which seems to be, you have to sleep with the eggs, which is inadvertently what Dany does, subconsciously, I guess. And what Aegon V, in comparison, does not. You know, it is explicitly mentioned in the Duncan Egg novellas that his egg is in Summerhall. He doesn't take it with him, obviously, of course, but that could lead to his later problems to get it to hatch. I don't know.
well, might be. Didn't he have it in the cradle with him when he was growing up?
Yeah. But the children in the Dance of the Dragon story are mentioned. I mean, they are what, 9, 10 or something, and they still sleep with their ex. And they put
I
it
think
in
that's his... actually a, probably a bonding thing. It's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
How is it that a dragon chooses a particular writer? I think it's got something to do with this long-term this long-term bonding process. I mean, and the interesting thing was, first of all, it makes me think more about this, the importance of the dragon mount on Dragonstone, that there's something about the volcanic nature of this island that is conducive to birthing dragons, and maybe this explains why the Targaryens chose these otherwise not particularly, you know, useful islands as their kind of ancestral home base.
For sure. Well, I mean, when you think about it, Valyria is obviously a volcanically active area of this planet, as we learned during the Doom of Valyria, when volcanoes destroy it completely. And then in terms of potential magical significance, obsidian, dragonglass, which is a product of volcanic activity, is capable of destroying the others. So, you know, it could be a climactic consideration. It could be proximity to the wells of warmth beneath the ground. It could be some magical thing, you know, fire magic, effectively. That is then later reflected in obsidian being this weapon against this, the supernatural force. So there's something, there's, I think, certainly something to that. Yeah.
But going back to the hatching thing, we get this little girl mentioned that she prays that her egg will hatch. So it seems like they cannot control it. So it is not any kind of magic ritual, Daenerys style, that gets you to hatch the dragons. Normally it seems like they just did it at some time. And I think it really has to do with this whole bondage thing, bonding, not bondage, thing that's going on if you take the egg into bed with you all the time, so that the dragon at some point thinks it's time or whatever. It at least seems to be a very important thing about it, you know? And obviously that's something that they don't do anymore later. They just put it in the cradle like a family tradition. But it's not like they really understand why it was done, I think.
I don't know. This seems like reading way too much into that to me. Like, okay, I think, you know, these are valuable heirlooms that they carry around because they're important. It's a sign of your importance. I think they're probably, you know, kids are raised to understand that, yes, you need to form a bond with this animal, and it starts before birth, and it starts with the egg. But I don't think it stems from dragon hatching science, for want of a better term, that they have figured out like what this means. My sense, and nothing I read in this story changed that for me, has always been that back in the day, dragons hatched with some regularity and consistency, and then over time that just sort of trickled away, and they hatched without all that much rhyme or reason to it, and then by the time Daenerys comes around, only death can pay for life. Only that kind of ritualistic circumstance is capable of bringing dragons back into the world.
Also, I think there's a difference between, if you will, fresh eggs and petrified stone eggs.
Right, yeah, because at this point, we know who laid these eggs, you know. Those dragons are still alive, or people's grandparents knew those dragons, or... You know, it's not like, oh, here's an ancient egg that someone found in a shy. You know, it's different. It's not a fossil.
Yeah.
It's an actual egg that was laid within living memory.
So the dragons were quite interesting. I do think we should talk about them. This sort of gambit to, recruit Targaryen bastards. And clearly the Targaryens had a policy of spreading it around to kind of keep these people in, in reserve, as it were. But you know, what's astonishing is the attrition rate. I mean, Jace Targaryen recruits these people, and like 16 of them die during the attempt to tame these dragons. And the result is he gets 4 dragon riders. Like, that's a huge attrition rate. And you can really see, like, you know, the difficulty of this process, that even, you know, back when the Targaryens knew how this stuff worked, that it's not like flicking on a light switch. This is like dangerous, uncertain, and unstable.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that I think it's worth thinking about this in a couple ways. One is rewind to Old Valyria, where I believe all the noble houses had dragons, and picture what that society must have been like in terms of turnover of heirs to these houses, in terms of how battle worked, in terms of what a Valyrian civil war would have looked like, in terms of the stakes involved when the Targaryens are sort of, they're basically turned out of society, correct? Like it's they leave because,
sorry,
when the Targaryens leave Valyria, they've sort of fallen out of favor politically and culturally. Am I right?
No, they chose exile because they seemed to know of the doom.
Jor-El situation.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But Jor-El was a laughingstock.
I think in this case, obviously, they didn't bother to explain anything.
They just split.
Okay, we've had this prophecy. We're getting the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there's still my point is that there's everything. The stakes get a lot higher when you have flying nuclear dinosaurs to employ. When that's the cost of a coming of age is potentially being burned to death. When that's a factor in battle, and you know, we talked about it earlier, how small the forces become when that's something that you need to take into consideration in terms of your tactics. I think that there winds up being, and we see it as these pretender kings rise, where their only claim to fame is that they can get on the back of a dragon and the dragon does what it wants them to do. All of a sudden you have a lot of would-be commanders out there, and that trickles down to a sort of breakdown in central authority. It trickles down to, again, a military tactical thing where you have a lot of different people saying, like, I'm going to lead this battle and there's really not much you can do about it, and okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
you see that time and again on both sides.
The bit at Tumbleton, where it's just this army disintegrates because when you have a dragon rider, what the hell can you do with, you know, you can't give them orders that they don't want to take. That's really cool. And, actually one potentially associated thing that I just wanted to bring up because I thought it was really interesting is that Rhaenyra, God damn it, I'm never going to get this right, giving birth to a monster at the outbreak of the Civil War, just like Dany did.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot.
That was really interesting because it suggests the possibility that the part of the way that the Targaryens suppressed the negative – well, first of all, it suggests that one of the side effects of this relentless incest is, like, you know, not just occasional mental problems, but that, you know, physical problems start coming up, and that this is dealt with through infanticide, which was a historical pattern in times in which royal incest was practiced, is that you would sort of cull children in order to prevent the, you know, when the genetic dice rolled up badly.
Well, also the genetic dice are rolling badly, not just like, oh, they have microcephaly or, you know, learning disabilities. Like, they have tails, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is magic. It's not just the normal problems that can multi-generational incest could lead to. It's, you know, because I don't want to get in a whole digression about this, but only to, like, to me, in a Game of Thrones, it's only Jorah's acquiescence to this description that made me think that this wasn't just hyperbole, that this kid actually did come out that kind of fucked up looking. And so now we have another case in the historical record. Granted, it's history as practiced by Westerosi maesters and may not be the most reliable thing in the world. It's not the most reliable thing in the world. But it does seem like there is a pattern of Targaryen children, stillborn Targaryen children, actually having some dragon-like features. And that's okay. Didn't see that one coming, you know? So it's all the things that you say are true in terms of how that practice of incest manifests itself in terms of childbearing. But there's also that additional magical element to it.
Mm-hmm. So one sort of last bit on the dragons that I wanted to talk about is this amazing scene, the riot at the dragon pit.
Oh yeah.
Which I just, like, to me, that was the best part of this short story, was you get this sense of the power of the mob of King's Landing, that it's not an anomaly what happened in A Clash of Kings, that it really is like the small folk do at certain times and places have a historically powerful presence, that they can wipe out. Yeah, and they basically did. They wiped out the last of the dragons.
Yeah.
You know, they lost 2,000 people to do it, but that is just impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
It's reminiscent to me of, in 1984, Winston and O'Brien and Julia frequently talk about the idea of the proles rising up, and how when that happens, it'll literally be like a force of nature. Like, all the proles need to do is sort of shake, and it'll be like a hippopotamus shaking birds off its back, you know. And it's not quite that even, but you do see the raw power of the masses, and you do see why it's wise for aristocrats in King's Landing and in the Red Keep to be terrified of these people. Because, yeah, they just they kill the flying nuclear dinosaurs.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that it tells you a lot about what it was like to live in a world with dragons, that it's this constant cosmic fear, that these specks up in the sky can come hurtling down and destroy entire regions, and that, you know, finally people just get so afraid and so angry and so fed up that they accomplish something seemingly physically impossible. And this is why, like, I'm now something of a convert to this whole Maester conspiracy theory, because, you know, if you're alive and you're a survivor of this war and you're not a Targaryen, why the hell wouldn't you want all the dragons dead?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. That really is, in many ways, a legitimate public service. If you don't actually believe that in the threat of the others and don't think the dragons would have anything to do with that, dragons are bad news for people.
That's my first take that I had while I was reading this short story, novella, whatever, was dragons are evil. In my notes, I have it in capital letters. Dragons are terrible. Yeah, you know, I wanted to come to that later. Because dragons really are not only a force of nature, they are atomic bombs, and those people are hitting the red button repeatedly, you know. We have so many bloody massacres involving those dragons, and when they fight, the collateral damage is breathtaking. Think of this battle, I think it was at Maidenpool, where the first real dragon battle happens, when they slam into the ground and kill, 20, 30, 40, I don't know, people instantly and burn about 100 others or what?
It was at Rook's Roost.
Yeah, wherever that is. Point is, when those dragons fight, usually, the battle at the God's Eye being a little exception, when those dragons fight, you really have people suffering for it. Think of the terror that the populace of King's Landing is experiencing at the news of this upcoming Targaryen civil war, how they begin to duck in those cellars and expect a whole city with them to burn, to completely burn down. And on a smaller scale, this is what happens at Tumblestone. The names in this thing. You know what I mean? It's just so brutal, this fighting with the dragons, so killing them. I couldn't really feel sorry. I know many people felt like this, you know, this, oh my god, we don't have dragons anymore, and oh, the dragons are so cool when they fight and all that, but I couldn't really feel it. And it reinforced this feeling in me that Sean and I have talked a lot about this on the Board Leather Audio Hour, that all the Martin riots is essentially an anti-war story. And I never felt so strongly that this theory of ours is right than when reading The Queen and the Princess.
Yeah, Martin will talk about how war, and he, you know, I think in the Barristan, well, you know, I won't say anything. Never mind. It's a preview chapter from Winds of Winter, so I won't say anything about it. But
It's been published in the paperback.
So. Yeah, but even still, fuck it. Yeah, you know, Barristan. He basically has Barristan come out and say something that he said, which is that war is both the most glorious thing and the most terrible thing that you'll ever experience. And the point that Stefan and I have made is that the glory is ultimately sort of the bait that the terror uses to lure you in. And that seems to me to be how these dragon fights work in this story. I mean, that's awesome. You know, it is awesome to watch dragons fight and fly and attack each other and like have midair kaiju battles and do all this cool crazy shit and burn people alive, and you know, all that stuff is great, and it's a lot of fun to watch Martin flex his high fantasy muscles in that way. But yeah, you can't ever lose sight of the human cost of it, because he won't allow you to. It's horrifying, you know, everyone riding into battle on Godzillas. That's horrifying. And there's a temptation, I think, because of the way the maesters are presented, when you start getting wind of this maester conspiracy theory and it's presented to you in the voice of Marwyn the Mage, and refers to them as the gray sheep or whatever, and that the maesters were doing something sinister and evil and ignoble in... if they were, in fact, trying to extinguish dragons from the world. But this sort of helps you see it from the maester's perspective, and it's like, if your goal is to serve the realm, like, why the fuck would you want these things around? You wouldn't.
Yeah.
They don't...
There's no reason, really.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it turns out they're probably wrong in the sense that dragons, I'm guessing, and I think all of us are guessing, will have a linchpin role in defeating the others, and a role that they didn't have the first time around, because Valyria had nothing to do with Westeros at that point, and Essos does not reach it far north, and there's no way for the others to menace Essos. So that didn't happen then. Maybe it will happen, you know, it might happen now, and so the maesters will wind up being wrong, but based on the information they have in front of them, when they write, you know, imagine writing the story of this war, and then your conclusion is like, we should do whatever we can to keep the dragons alive and thriving. Like, I fucking doubt it.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. So, sort of to move from the high fantasy to low politics, sort of an interesting thing that I noticed is the relative weakness of houses Tully and Tyrell in comparison to the other great houses, at least at this particular point in time, in that the Tullys, you know, can't really hold the Riverlands together. They don't have the authority or the power that the moment that Harrenhal falls, that the Riverlands rise up against them. And likewise, you know, the Tyrells, even though they have a better hold over their forces, are seen as somewhat the puppets of the Hightowers.
Yeah. But that's nothing new, right? I mean, the hold of those great lords on their domains was always a bit strained. Just think of the War of the Usurper, where Baratheon is not near able to keep all his bannermen together. Arryn isn't. The Tullys aren't. So that's nothing new.
Yeah, but it seems, at least in the context of the story, that they are more so, in part because they are more recent. That, you know, the Starks, for example, don't have any problems during this war of gathering together a huge troop of men and then sending them forth to just, like, ride through any Southerner that they feel like. I mean, I did like the Winter Wolves' presence, and you sort of get the sense of that the Southern conception of the North are these, like, crazy wild horsemen who every so often show up and just massacre people, and that they're kind of uncontrollable.
Well, you know, it stands to reason that that's the South's view of the North, because there's no invading the North, right? You'd have to get through the Neck, and which is effectively impossible, and it's huge and virtually ungovernable. So the only time you're going to encounter forces from the North is when they're sweeping down to murder you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other sort of interesting political thing that really does change our understanding of the way the world works is that previously Essos and Westeros have been very separate in the series, and you don't really get a sense that the two interact with one another politically. And here we see a massive involvement of Essos in Westerosi politics, that the Iron Bank of Braavos holds a quarter of the royal treasury, that Pentos is willing to take in refugees, that Myr, Lys, and Tirosh, like, side in with one side of a civil war. And the other thing we learn is that at one point in time, Myr, Lys, and Tirosh were one country.
Yeah. Triarchy, is it?
Yes, the Triarchy of the Three Sisters.
Okay. Yeah, as I also thought this interesting. And also the fighting on the Stepstones, where they learned to fight dragons. Which brings me to yet another point. Dragons are quite mortal, aren't they? And for me, this is one of the big foreshadowings in this. I am now more convinced than ever that at least one of Daenerys' dragons will die. Because we can see just how easily they die. And Daenerys's are very little compared to what flies around in this story. So I'd say one of them gets killed at least. And before they meet the others.
Interesting.
Don't you think so?
No, they're all going to be ridden. They're all going to have riders.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That I don't doubt.
But oh,
I
so think what do you mean by them... before they meet the others? Oh, the others, the actual others. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, the actual one, the White Walkers.
Got it, got it, got it. Oh, thank you. That's very helpful. And from now on, let's refer to Asha as Yara, too. I think that will help me, too.
No, no.
Oh, man. No, but really, I think it will make for a very strong narrative element if one of the dragons is killed before they meet the others, because the White Walkers. Because on the one hand, we can see yet again that they are that they can die, and if it happens in a kind of that collateral damage situation, that I am sure will transpire at some time. He can't build up to that moment without the dragons going on a rampage and killing people they ought not to kill, you know. And if it is killed and it later really is, the lack of the third dragon is really felt during the fights, it will be a very interesting ambivalence, I think.
Well, I mean, one possible way that that could happen is if one of them gets successfully turned by Victarion, and then Dany fighting with him, you know, dragon on dragon, leads to one dragon dying, you know?
I will bet $1,000 that Victarion does not successfully turn a dragon.
I'm not taking that bet because I don't have that either. And I think that it's
either.
I actually think that's pretty likely.
Well, damn it, I can't get you to take the bet, huh? Oh well. Yeah, no money will change hands, but I will have the satisfaction.
Gentleman's bet.
Okay.
Okay. I have to mention one thing before I completely forget about it. The most terrifying and shocking moment for me in the whole story was right in the beginning with blood and cheese.
God, that was horrible.
That was so horrible. I think it didn't exactly trump the Red Wedding in shock value, but in what it meant, I really sat there with my book, and I was totally horror struck. It's like they aren't doing this, you know. They can't be real. They can't be something that happened, and it is so brutal. I mean, perhaps I am. Okay, let's start it from the beginning. I have experienced in this last year that I am more susceptible to plots that involve the threatening of children, since I have one of my own, as a disclaimer in the beginning. So I might overreact, but I really think that this scene was so really so horrible. I can't stand it. And the second time around, when I knew what was coming, it was even more terrible, you know. If you think this through, this choice that she is given, and the only the idea that this child, Melon, whatever he's called, just understood what was happening there, this is really so gross. And I had a very very short chat with Elio Garcia about it, and he said something along the lines that this was George R. R. Martin remembering his roots in the horror genre. And I guess that fits, you know. It is really a horror element. And this leads me to the next question, which is a poll that was taken or is currently taken on Tower of the Hand. Which faction would you join, the Blacks or the Greens? And I immediately said the Greens, and the overwhelming majority is obviously with the Blacks, because you have to honor your oaths, you know. And I said, I will never go in the same faction where Prince Damon is, you know. If I can choose, I choose the faction that tries to kill Prince Damon, because that guy is nuts. Totally.
I'm with Team Small Folk, you know.
Yeah, but that's not a
decision. It's a cop out. Come on.
It's not a cop out. That's a strongly.
I stand
held
with the people.
Well, no, it's not just that. It's like, honestly, you know, yes, it's horrible that Damon like sent assassins to murder, you know, to murder children, and then turn around and think, well, how many children died when Aemond decided to torch the Riverlands, you know, village by village?
Right. Well, that's something Martin's...
God, that's the next thing.
I want
that's
both of these sides to lose.
That's something Martin's playing with. You know, he'll have a full paragraph obituary for the queen that never was, and then be like, oh yeah, and several dozen other people died that day too. You know, like, I mean, it's funny in a grim sort of way, you know, and that's the point he's making, is that history and Westeros society... And honestly, it's still not a whole lot different in 2013 in the real world. It's based on great men shit. And, you know, that certain deaths have more impact and value, and certain lives have more value, by extension, than others.
That's what I meant right at the beginning when I talked about the collateral damage that we see in the whole story. Mm-hmm. It is just so so gross to see how many people die in this dragon warfare and are taken in as this collateral damage and not even really mentioned. This guerrilla warfare thing that goes on there. And he explicitly says it is like Aegon the Conqueror fought the same way. So that is, oh my God, that is so horrible. I am really so glad that dragons are gone from the world. And I come to see more and more that this last Daenerys chapter in A Dance with Dragons, the Myrinese Blood, is so right about this. This is nothing good will come out of Daenerys finally embracing the role of Daenerys the Conqueror. This will be such a bloody mess.
Except for possibly the salvation of the human race.
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. I'm pretty sure that Daenerys will come back from embracing the bloody Conqueror at some point. And until she does, she will leave a trail of corpses behind. I'm pretty certain.
Well, you start, one thing that's interesting about this, and this is a total digression, I realize, but you start realizing the utility of a Dark Lord character and a race of orcs. You know, like in Tolkien's work, Tolkien used them to embody the horror of war rather than sort of diffuse it among two sides who are both committing crimes and doing things of horror as well as valor. So you understand, like, my point is, I think you kind of have to be an actual moron to read The Lord of the Rings and think of it as this good, evil, black, white, happy ending fairy tale. At the same time, it's not this complex, and I think that's why, and I think Tolkien did that on purpose. I think he chose to create this sort of thoroughgoingly evil antagonist force so that he could embody the horror of war in them and what they did and what they did alone. And you see the ramifications of participating in war even on among the good guys, but they never commit atrocities, really, unless you count, like, Boromir trying to steal the ring and things like that. So it can be... And I think you see in the fandom, perhaps, maybe people lose sight of that and still take a side because of, you know, whatever the most recently... whatever the thing is that has been most recently presented to you. You know, like in the case of Daenerys, you've seen her rule in Meereen, and you've seen that go to shit. And so you're like, yeah, we need Daenerys the Conqueror. That's what she should, that's what she ought to be doing. Things will go better. And it's like, well, not necessarily. You know, and there's a certain directness of purpose that's lost when you don't have such a clear-cut struggle. You know what I mean? I'm not complaining. I'm just saying.
Yeah, see, I take exception to that particular case. Just because I do think that, and I've now argued this in print, that I think that Martin has a certain Machiavellian sensibility to him, and I mean that not in the sort of the narrow sense, in like actually what Machiavelli thought, in that, you know, there's a famous part in The Prince where he talks about cruelty, and he says, it's better to get your cruelty, you know, done straight away and then never have to do it again, then try to be nice, and then you get this bleeding ulcer. Because, you know, I mean, my sort of take from the Marine stuff, and it's going to be ages and ages before I ever get to do the chapter by chapter on this, but, you know, Daenerys tries to essentially mollify a former slave master population while trying to create a revolution, you know, a social and economic revolution. And, you know, by leaving them in place and in positions of power, I think that, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people died, you know, at the sack of Astapor, at the siege of Meereen, you know, the killings of the Sons of the Harpy. And I think to myself, well, you know, if Dany had just taken out the slave masters of Yunkai and Meereen, as she did in Astapor, how many thousand more people would be alive? And what does it, you know, ultimately mean to be cruel or to be, you know, kind?
Not to point out the obvious, but Astapor wasn't exactly a success story.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think the reason why Astapor wasn't a success story is that she pulls out every last soldier in Astapor, including the 600 unsullied who normally served as the city's garrison. And no government is going to survive in a world in which it doesn't have military power to keep itself in office.
Yeah, well, I think that leads us too far away from the novella, but I still don't agree.
Yeah.
Well, I have a way to get back to the novella, and this is something I've been dying to talk to you guys about since we started recording, and it's this. You know, judging from the tone of our discussion at this point, I think we all appear to agree that this is a message novella, right? Like that the same thematic considerations that Martin brings to bear on his more traditionally formatted and structured and written work of fiction are still coming through here. And that's interesting to me for this reason. I've often joked, with some heat behind it, actually, that to judge from the comments of certain readers, it seems like what they really want is not a novel, but a Wikipedia entry. They just want like a series of incidents, you know, jotted down, and you know, anything else than that is sort of gets in the way of what they're looking for. And in a lot of ways, that's more or less what the princess and the queen is. There's, you know, there's drama and there's dialogue and stuff, you know, that's reconstructed to a degree that I'm not sure actually befits the nominal idea that this was a history written down by somebody. But, you know, there's not, there's no room for Brienne wandering around looking for Sansa, right? You know, that's something that has always really interested me, but it's not to a lot of people's taste. And I'm curious as to whether you guys feel that this sort of structure with the third person quasi-omniscient narration and the, you know, just sort of recounting a series of battles and confrontations and it seems a lot more in tune, perhaps, with that sort of Wikipedia style of fiction. Does it change how this message is conveyed? Does it change the force with which it gets through? What do you guys think?
I thought it was more strongly. I got the message more strongly, but that doesn't have to say anything because I have only been really my sensibilities have gone up for this only after I read Dance with Dragons and discussed it with you all the time and wrote the essays and stuff. So I'm not really representative, I think.
Well, also, you said that you weren't as crazy, Stefan, about it as a read, right? That the historical format lessened your enjoyment of it. Am I misreading you?
No, not at all. That was one of the first impressions I took from it on the structural level, you know, was this is not really an enjoyable read. It is interesting, it is engaging, but I don't enjoy reading it. And I was glad when I was finished because now I had all the information and I hadn't to endure this very dry writing anymore. So that was not like Westeros, where I like to lose myself in the chapters and in the details and the food they eat and the wounds they take and all that. This is just an info dump.
Mm-hmm. Stephen,
I think it's sort of similar to, you know, there's some fans of J.R.R. Tolkien who love, you know, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and can't stand The Silmarillion. And then there's some who are the kind of the opposite.
Uh-huh.
I think there was maybe a sort of a sense in which Martin was like, all right, fine. I'm going to give you like the real, you know, unfiltered, 100% proof, uncut, you know, Silmarillion style stuff. And let's see if you like it. and, you know, I enjoyed it to an extent. But for me, you know, as someone who like really loves the history of all of this, it's almost more fun to look for bits and pieces in the narrative style of A Song of Ice and Fire than to have it given to you in a chunk. You lose the treasure hunt aspect. So I like that, the foraging for information in these little bits and pieces.
Yeah, that's the thing. I really enjoyed it, despite really also deeply enjoying things like A Feast for Crows, that, you know, there's this perception that it's kind of a slog. I still really like this, even though it is so different in style. You know, because I like bouncing around A Wiki of Ice and Fire. I like talking, yeah, I'm kind of a full purpose A Song of Ice and Fire nerd, you know. So I like all those elements, but it was very different, and it seems like that bears some consideration, you know.
Yeah, it is. I'm not exactly sure whether I'm looking forward to the World of Ice and Fire now. I mean, it is really interesting and all, and I will devour it, no question about it. But I really, I'm really more excited for The Winds of Winter, definitely.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that almost goes without saying. It's such a different experience.
Yeah, definitely.
How do you think this will,
Yes.
Does it play into your expectations for the next Dunkin' Egg story?
I don't know how it does compute.
I mean, I like the Dunkin' Egg story style better for this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
For getting the history with more of a kind of, through the eyes of a person and in the way that they experience the world. I'm certainly very interested to see what, like, Winterfell is like at the time of Dunkin' Egg.
Yeah.
But now I want to see it through the eyes of Dunkin' Egg. I'm less into reading some maester give me a description of all of that.
Right. Which is not to say, I mean, obviously we all know that, you know, the maester takes sides at times, and it's not like you're getting, it's not like a Wikipedia entry in the sense that it's like objective, but at the same time, or purporting even, but it's different than getting someone's emotions and feelings and instant reactions on the ground the way you do from the writing Martin does, where it's sort of focalized through one of the participants, a POV character or Dunk. And that makes a big difference. I think there's room for this. You know, if he winds up coming out with, if this is how A World of Ice and Fire or the eventual G.R.R. M. Merillion works, I'll enjoy it, but it's obviously a very different animal. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. It's not bad by any thing, but the novels are better. Just
I think the way that I would phrase it is that if and when the World of Ice and Fire finally comes out, I will definitely use it as a reference book. I will go back to it to cite things and remember things. I don't think I'll reread it for fun.
Yes.
That seems fair. It'll be a dusty old tome sitting on Grandmaster Pacell's desk somewhere.
And in 100 years, an archaeologist will come up and say, who was this guy?
Well, going in there, getting tinctures to keep their bowel movements regular. And they're like, oh, this looks exciting. I think that – does that cover everything?
I think so,
yeah.
Yes.
I think we're good.
Good for us, man. Good for us. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I always like talking to you, and I really appreciated the expertise that you're able to bring to bear on these issues, because it's. I think it requires a certain way of thinking about how this.
Well, yeah. If and when the World of Ice and Fire comes out, or the Winds of Winter, you know, give me a Skype call.
Right on,
definitely.
And thank you all once again for listening. As always, it's a pleasure to have your electronic, invisible, inaudible company. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.